Hey everybody, welcome to Roger and Me, aka Roger Ebert and Me, a Siskel and Ebert tribute movie review podcast in which two film critics, myself, Brett Arnold, at Brett Redacted on Twitter.com, we're taking it back, we're not calling it Elon Musk X anymore, who cares, and Mark Dusick of MarkReviewsMovies.com, at MarkReviews on Twitter.com. We are here to review all the new movies that come out every Friday, as we are wont to do. This week, there are six, maybe seven. There's actually some suspense to this episode. We don't even know if we're going to be covering seven at this point in time. We have six on the docket. There's a seventh Apple release that the screener has not, as of recording time, come up yet. It may drop before Friday. If it does, we will sub in a little video where we're dressed differently, probably. And we talk about that movie. So that'll be number seven. But if we don't, we have plenty to talk about. Six movies, including a wide release in Wonka, some smaller fare in American Fiction, The Zone of Interest, The Taste of Things, The Sweet East, and a foreign film in Concrete Utopia. It's the end of the year. There's one more week of new releases, I believe. So Mark and I have only a couple movies left to see. I think three movies that are left to screen. Everything else is like for your consideration. There's Oscar screeners, but Migration, actually, I think Migration is trying to have a for your consideration campaign also. So
it's a little late for
it is a little
most
late.
Of the groups.
Yeah. But in New York City, there's like the press screening, and then there's like, if you want, there's a for your consideration screening as well. So Migration, which is an animated movie that, sorry, listeners, there are screenings. They're being very kind. There's two of them. But I don't know if I care to leave the house for a kid's movie. Well, my kid will be making me watch all that shit soon enough. Not yet. And then Aquaman is coming out at the end of the year, and that we'll have that next week. And then there's one more that I'm forgetting. Oh, Color Purple, which we've seen. And then isn't there another thing?
Oh, there's so much.
The Boys in the Boat.
The Boys in the Boat, Ferrari.
We've seen Ferrari.
Yeah, hold on a second. All of Us Strangers. I don't know if you saw Freud's Last Session yet. That comes out on
no,
on
but I do okay. have it, so I guess I should watch.
We'll find out if we have to hold off on that one. Look, next week is packed to an extreme extent. I didn't realize it while I was
listing these things. I was like, we have it easy. Yeah. It's the
Iron
year.
Claw comes
oh,
out.
God, it's There's, so oh, okay.
it's packed. Yeah, I'll be seeing Iron Claw very, very soon, apparently. So that's good. Okay. So next week's going to be packed, and then like nothing comes out that last weekend of the year. So
hopefully we can do a nice end of the year roundup before we start talking about 2024 movies, which I've already seen a few screeners, none of which, you know, I'll just say it's January or it's about to be January. So the stuff I've seen is all January related, if that means anything to you. Anyway, this week, we're not quite at that end of the year push yet, but we've got plenty to talk about. Damn, I wish I knew that next week was so loaded, because I would have said, let's talk about some of the other ones today. But who cares? We'll do it all next week. It'll be a nice holiday bonus long one. Let's get right into it with Wonka.
I spent the past 7 years traveling the world perfecting my craft. You see, I'm something of a magician, inventor, and chocolate maker. So quiet up and listen down. Nope, scratch that, reverse it.
Mr. Wonka, I can see you're a man of great ingenuity.
What are you doing?
I'm making chocolate, of course. How do you like it? Dark, white, nutty, absolutely insane.
Many people have come here to sell chocolate. They've all been crushed by the chocolate cartel. You can't get a shop without selling chocolate. And you can't sell chocolate without a shop.
No daydreaming.
What are we gonna do, Willy?
Huh.
Huh?
So I think a lot of people wanted to hate this based on the trailer that, I will say, after you see the movie, it plays a little better. But I don't know. It doesn't sell it to me in a way that I was expecting to enjoy the actual movie. But I'm bearing the lead here. This movie's good, and I'm surprised. And I guess the lesson is, we should never doubt the Paddington guy. This movie's made by Paul King, the guy who directed and wrote, is that correct? Yeah, directed and wrote Paddington, Paddington 2, and also this movie. So we've all learned a lesson here. Wonka is good. Mark, please walk me through how this came to be. How is this good?
I don't know, honestly, how it's good, but it is good. I'm going to agree with you. It's good. It takes inspiration, obviously, from the 71 film. It's a musical, straight up musical, which I think might be part of the reason why the trailer doesn't play as well, because it feels as if it's just straightforward sort of origin story, but it doesn't play that way. It's just Willy Wonka, now played by Timothée Chalamet, on another adventure to try to start up his chocolate shop in a European city that's clearly Paris, but I don't think it's set up to be Paris because he ends up at a German castle at the end. Whatever. The point is, it's fun and it's full of songs that don't match the memorability of the original movie, obviously. The fact that there are two songs from the original film that come into this, you're like, yeah, these new ones don't quite hold up to that. But what does? What holds up to the Oompa Loompa song? What holds up to Pure Imagination? Not much when it comes to movie musicals. So I don't know what else to say in broad terms, because it's just a lot of fun as a musical. I think Chalamet is it's not fair, but it's inevitable. He's not as good as Gene Wilder in this role, but he's also doing his own spin on it, which I think kind of works.
On that note, it won me over by the end.
Yes.
But
yeah,
I think it is hard to accept him at first, not just as Wonka, but as like zany. And I think he has a hard time being like wacky, but by the end of the movie, I think it's just because of the way the movie's written and like the surrounding characters being so funny and everyone around him also being funny that it helps build him up. And by the end of the movie, you're totally like, it is young Willy Wonka. I totally believe this. And I think he did a good job, even though at the start of the movie, just like when I watched the trailer, it's a little grating at first. It seems like it's not going to work, but by God, it does work. And I think that a big part of why it does work, Mark, is that the movie is aware that it's inherently ridiculous to be prequelizing Willy Wonka and giving him like a tragic backstory with like, you know, a dead mom and stuff like that. But it's so funny because in spite of the fact that I'm saying it's inherently ridiculous to do all that, the movie does do all that, does have the emotional backstory that does hit you at the end in a way I was not expecting. But all the while, my point is, the movie is so silly. And it matches the inherent ridiculousness of prequelizing Willy Wonka. It is silly, silly, silly. There are plenty of laughs throughout, and it has so much charm to spare. I'm glad the trailer got into it, but it's a movie about like chocolate cartels and corrupt cops that are addicted to candy. And there's like a wash house indentured servitude subplot. Like everything about it is completely ludicrous. And that is why it works. It is so funny. And even throwaway gags like the Oompa Loompa character and what he's doing in the movie, I found that backstory even very inspired and silly. So even, I guess my whole point is it's like a contradiction to me where it shouldn't work on this emotional level. It shouldn't work as a prequel that has Wonka elements that like, you know, nostalgia bait you into feeling something. But all of that stuff works. And I think it works because the movie doesn't take itself seriously, even though it ultimately does take itself seriously, because I cried at the end of this movie, is my point. Am I making any sense?
No, you are making sense. I think, okay, so yeah, you are making sense. There's a lot of things that play as goofy. A lot of things that play as goofy. The entire supporting cast is full of... They got Keegan-Michael Key, they got Rowan Atkinson, they got Tom Davis, they got Olivia Colman, who's not necessarily a comedic actor, but she's really funny here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who else. There's got to be more people I'm forgetting.
There are British people I don't recognize.
There are British comedians playing like walk-on roles.
Yes,
like
exactly.
I recognize a couple of them from panel shows in the UK. I'm like, oh, right. I know that guy. I know that person. And it was fun to see all these actors come together and pull off this tone just right, because isn't that the whole point of the tone? It is that mixture of being sincere and darkly goofy. If anything, I think this one misses out on the darkness of
you're right, like the other
the
movie,
original 71 one.
Children are being essentially murdered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah,
that we don't have that.
It,
yeah,
it doesn't have that goofy level
but
to
it. Have a giraffe being milked.
It does have a giraffe being milked, which I was not expecting at all, but it's a good bit. That whole scene in the zoo when they grab the balloons and they're walking on water and floating on top of that train station, that's wonderful. I'm just going to say it. It's wonderful. I don't care that the visual effects could be a bit garish at times. They don't
look
the best thing. But the entire concept of that scene is just like, yeah, I don't remember the song from it. Again, the songs are not as memorable as from the original film, but who cares? The visuals in that scene, the entire concept of that scene of them floating on those balloons is just,
you know,
it's just great.
It is great, man. I do think it's great. It's got well-trodden family movie tropes, like don't give up on your dreams no matter the circumstances and despite all the forces conspiring against you. It's got a social commentary message about class and the affordability of chocolate and the monopoly that corporations lord over people. So like, it's just got so much going on. I was just so taken with it and so unexpectedly, because I definitely like put it on like with arms shrugged, like let's get through this. Like, I didn't expect it to be such a wonderful, delightful, enjoyable experience. And I enjoy the like, he's a magician with making chocolate of it all, and how the chocolate all has magical properties and how that manifests. It's all just so silly and fun. And I don't know why I didn't expect them to pull it off, but, and I think it's because of like, probably because of the inherent thanklessness of any actor trying to do a Willy Wonka thing now. But he does, I'm telling you, by the end of this movie, if you're not won over, I feel like you weren't paying attention. You have a heart of stone. Because this movie, I feel like such a sap or such a mark when they were.
Hey, I resemble that remark.
in the wrestling term, mark.
I know.
I know you know what I mean. I feel like a mark in that they did the thing where, like, I make fun of like Marvel audiences like cheering like seals at something in the movie. I absolutely had that moment in this movie when they bring in the pure imagination at a perfect moment, and you're like, oh my god, I'm crying. Why am I crying? Like, this is so fucked up.
Because it pays. It pays off so well, because it does set up those sincere moments. It sets up with the orphan child and with the mother backstory. Having Sally Hawkins play the mother is just like, that's perfect casting.
The mom from Paddington, right, of course.
Yeah. Exactly. She's just right and for that. The, and
the,
so
the lady who fucked the fish and the Best Picture winner.
That too.
As she's forever known now.
Yeah. The right combination of sweet and weird. It's just right.
It's perfect. And Hugh Grant, I guess I expected more Hugh Grant and Oompa Loompa stuff, but what's in there is like, I'll take it. It works. It's very funny. And I love that he's going to the press right now. Anyone he talks to, he's like, I fucking hated doing this. I hated being the Oompa Loompa. It was all digital bullshit. I just sat there. He said it was horrible to do. But
you know what, though? Yeah. It works with the character.
It does.
You can kind of feel that energy, but it works with the character because the character doesn't want to be doing this.
I wonder if they reconstructed it around that, because it works perfectly. You're right. This is one of the biggest surprises of the year for me. If I'm doing a top 10, I don't think it'll be in there. But if I'm doing a top 25, 30, it could absolutely be in there. 3.5 stars for me for Wonka.
Oh, wow. A strong 3 stars for me, though. This is definitely not to be overlooked just because it doesn't seem like a good idea or the trailer puts you off. It's fun. And it's sweet.
It's a lot of fun.
And it's goofy.
It's everything I would want out of a family film that's Roald Dahl inspired. It really feels like a Broadway stage production too, which I thought was interesting, because for a second I was like, is there a Broadway musical based on Wonka that this is based on that I wasn't aware of? But there isn't. And I think I love that this feels like there is. Like, it makes it seem like, oh, this will be on Broadway one day, because it's, if this is a hit, it will be on Broadway. That's my prediction. And I do think it's going to be a hit. I think it's good enough that people will see it first weekend. It'll have great legs, like a good musical, like Greatest Showman did or whatever. I think this is a hit. I'm surprised. Congratulations to Warner Brothers, who are really cramming at the end of the year here, right? They've got 3 releases out between this and next week. We'll talk about those, the rest of them, next week. Including another musical, which people keep telling me is going to do very well, but I just don't see it happening based on the past, what, that 2021 year of musicals. West Side Story, Dear Evan Hansen, In the Heights, all bombs. And I think we've seen in the trailers for something like Wonka and the Mean Girls movie coming out next month that they're really hiding. They're hiding the fact that these things are musicals now, which is very interesting. Anyway, let's watch the trailer for American Fiction, which is not a musical, even though the trailer hides that it might be. Now every trailer, I'm like, is this a musical? Are they hiding something? The Zone of Interest, definitely musical. All right, I'm just kidding. Here is American Fiction.
How did you come to write this book?
What really struck me was that too few books were about my people. Where are our stories? Where's our representation?
Would you give us the pleasure of reading an excerpt?
Yo, Sharonda, girl, you be pregnant again? If I is, Ray Ray is gonna be a real father this time around. Thank you.
Monk, your books are good, but they're not popular. Editors, they want a black book.
They have a black book. I'm black, and it's my book.
You know what I mean.
Look at what they published. Look at what they expect us to write.
I just want to rub their noses in it.
That trailer makes it look so great, and it reminds me of how good that first half is of the movie. And then it just becomes kind of obvious from that exact trajectory of the trailer. If you weren't watching it, we'll explain what the plot is. But my big thing with this movie is it's so incisive and funny as this parody satire of what like white audiences want out of black art. And like it's got incisive jabs at like diversity for diversity's sake and stuff like that. And then it just kind of, I think it's intentional, Mark. The movie is definitely doing this as a joke and as a bit, but then the movie kind of stuffs itself with all this black family melodrama that the movie's making fun of. And I think by the end of the movie, it's maybe clear to some, maybe not clear to others, that it's kind of becoming what it's satirizing. So there's part of me, Mark, that is like, I will applaud this movie if it ends up completing the joke, completing the bit, and winning awards. Because I think that would be the ultimate joke, is if this movie that's making fun of how white audiences react to stuff like this, if it ends up getting awards play for doing those exact same things. So I think it's kind of like a meta funny thing. But the experience of watching the movie, and tell me if you agree, really fun for a while, and then it just kind of is stagnant in the, it stays kind of obvious with its satirical arc. I feel like we've seen this exact satire arc of guy writes something as a joke because he thinks it's terrible, and then society thinks it's great, and then he has to play along. And I just feel like it's a little tired, and we've seen it done more successfully. And now I will throw to you.
I'm surprised. I didn't think the family drama stuff, I'm going to call it drama, not melodrama. I mean, it does get close to it, but I think that's more the answer to the question of the satire, which is, where are all the legitimate black stories mm-hmm. that are just about people living their ordinary lives? And yeah, sure, there's a lot of stuff that happens to this family, but it's not what we see being parodied and satirized, which is gangs, drugs,
oh,
poverty,
it's so funny.
All that stuff. It's really funny. Yeah. Stories about enslavement. That's like, there's that commercial for, we're going to celebrate black voices on our cable channel, and every single clip that they show is from either a movie about gangs or from slavery, and that's all that they show on it. And it's like, where are those movies? And I think this movie is trying to be that answer to the
Got
question.
It. Okay.
I think. Now, if you think it played as melodrama, that's even more interesting, because I do wonder,
yeah,
like, oh, is it?
I like to think that they were being self-aware with that, especially the way it ends and stuff. But like, it's just funny to me that it's clearly a movie aimed at the audience that it's satirizing, I think. Even if you don't think that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's hard to tell.
How did you end up at 2.5, I guess, is my point.
My big problem with it is that I appreciate the fact that it is asking this question with the satire stuff, which is very funny. If it's a bit obvious, I don't really care, because it gets so specific about what it's targeting and how it's targeting it that I didn't care if it's obvious. And the answer is the family drama. They just don't feel of a piece in this movie. It doesn't, it seems as if it stops as soon as all the family stuff and the relationship stuff, because Jeffrey Wright's character meets this woman across the street from his mother's house and they have, you know, they start a relationship and it's nice and sweet and all that. But it's so isolated from the satire that it didn't line up for me, except on that thematic level of realizing that this is the answer that to the question the movie is asking. And so it just feels like two completely different movies and not one whole cohesive idea of what it's trying to get at. It didn't quite work on that level. I think it works on both of those levels as satire and as family drama. It didn't come together for me. And that's too bad, because it's really well acted. When it is in satirical mode, it's really funny. It's really, really funny.
When Issa Rae reads from that fucking book for the first time.
And I love the way that character plays out too. Eventually that character has more levels than we think based on his reaction to it. Yes. So I like that angle too, but
I ultimately wound up frustrated and disappointed, even though like I watched the first half of this movie twice, because I watched it and I was like, my wife came in the room. I'm like, you know what? Let's start this over. Like, I think you'll like this. And I watched like the first 40 minutes again, which made me like appreciate that part of it so much. And that's why I think it comes down so hard, is because you're right. It's completely split between the satire and the family drama. And again, I'm at a place where I think that is maybe part of a meta point, whatever. It doesn't make it more palatable or like go down easier. It's just kind of, I just don't know. I just don't know what it's getting at with that. Either it's doing what I think it's doing, or it's doing what you think it's doing. Either way, it doesn't.
But the fact that we can't tell its clear means, I think we both are in agreement. It doesn't work as an entire piece unto itself. It's just two separate ideas. And neither of us could agree where does that other half come into it? Where does the family drama come into it? Is it part of the satire, or is it the answer to the satire? We can't agree.
Yeah.
There's something missing here. There's something missing here.
It's a movie that wants to critique pandering to audiences. That's absolutely pandering to get Oscar nominations or award nominations. Like, that's all I can think about while watching it. And like, it sucks that I have to apply like a metatextual thing onto it, but I think it's a big part of what the movie's doing too. I swear, like, it just feels like someone commented on my post about it, saying like the ending's basically a dare to AMPUS voters. And like, I do feel that way. And it's especially funny, Mark, to see this, the Critics Choice category for Best Picture or whatever had this right next to like The Color Purple, which to me, The Color Purple embodies a lot of the things this movie is making fun of. So not to get ahead of ourselves here. Anyway, but I'm with you. It's a 2.5, but like an affectionate 2.5 that I really wish was a 3, but it's close. I still kind of say check it out if it looks funny, because it does have a lot of laughs, but those laughs don't mask that the movie doesn't come together with doing all the things it wants to do. Or maybe it does, and we're just dumb and missing it.
But I don't think so. I think we both get an idea there is some sort of metatextual connection between these two pieces, but we can't figure out why they feel so different within the actual movie itself. And Jeffrey Wright should probably go unspoken, but he's great again.
Of course, it's cool. Like, it's great to see him in a lead. Of course.
Yes. Yep.
There was another movie that. Was it not Macon Blair, the guy who directed the Macon Blair movies, Jeremy Saulnier. Didn't Jeremy Saulnier do that Netflix movie with Jeffrey Wright in the lead?
Yeah. I forget what it was called, Canada or Alaska, some sort of snowy movie.
Yeah.
I just remember it has a really, really bloody shootout.
It has like a violent set piece in the middle. I remember as well. Cool movie, and I can't remember the name of it all.
Yeah,
but it's classic Netflix movie. Maybe I don't fucking know. Jeremy Saulnier, Jeffrey Wright. Look it up. Good movie.
I'm actually looking it up now.
Mark will have the title when we come back from break and show the trailer for The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer's first movie since Under the Skin in 2013. Yes. Is that true? Crazy. One of those guys who makes movies very sporadically. Here is the trailer. Not a trailer that plays great over audio. But before we get into the movie, did you look up the title of the...
Hold the Dark.
Hold the Dark. I would have never got that
title. I would never. Yeah, me neither.
Not a very memorable title. Anyway, check out Hold the Dark. Zone of Interest. Jonathan Glazer. Holocaust film that keeps the Holocaust in the background in a way that is sickening and hard to watch and left a pit in my stomach, and easily one of the best movies of the year because no movie made me feel this way. Try to describe what this is about if you can.
It's somehow incredibly easy to describe it and also very, very difficult, because the easy part is it is about the commandant of Auschwitz and his family who live in a manor, basically, with an estate and a garden and a multiple story house right next to the camps, and you are just watching them go about their daily lives. That's the entire movie. But the trick of it is that there is not a single visual depiction of violence. There is no moment where a character is inside the camp that we actually see. We are just watching mostly static shots of this family walking around the house, walking around the property, talking about vacations they're going to go on, and they have gone on, talking about a transfer to Berlin that the commandant is about to have and how that's going to affect the family. In the background, though, there's this entire audio drama unfolding, and it's rising and rising. It starts off like this low rumble it looks like this idyllic family vacation at the start, and then they get to their house and you just hear that rumble and you're like, something is wrong here.
The occasional scream
building. Yeah, and it keeps building. There's this crescendo. Eventually you start hearing people yelling, you hear screams, you hear gunshots, and then the horrifying part of it is all these people are just standing around doing their stuff as if they can't hear what is right next to them, and they can't see the smoke coming out of the chimneys and the fumes of the smokestack from the train passing by all the trees carrying prisoners. It is jarring. It's unsettling. It's horrifying. It is exactly what a film about the Holocaust should be, without showing anything that actually happened. But we know exactly what happens here. We can see it happening. We can hear it happening, even if we don't see it visually depicted. It's so hard to describe. That's where it gets difficult to describe, that it doesn't sound like it's going to have that effect, but it
does.
Yeah, and you're right. It does get right into your stomach, like right in your gut.
It's a masterpiece in terms of like form and like the idea that it's doing, and the matching that idea in the form of the film. It is just exceptional. It is the banality, you know, of evil. Hannah Arendt's, that's her definition, I believe, that we got in the trial of Adolf Eichmann or whatever, that describes what the Nazis were doing and how it was able to happen because it became so commonplace every day systematically that it's banal. No one even questions it. And that's exactly what this movie is doing. You're watching people fold their laundry as a smokestack is in the background while people are being fucking burned in ovens. It is just horrifying. And the whole movie is about that dissonance, how you can live next door to that and live comfortably and just completely block out that evil because of whatever your belief, because you're a fucking Nazi or whatever. And it's just particularly hard to watch while we're having war going on, you know, in Israel or in Gaza, and you're watching certain people in this country decide which side they deserves their sympathy and which side doesn't. And this movie has harrowing shit like going through after they kill the Jews and they leave all their belongings on the ground. The Germans would go pick shit up and like scavenge. And I literally see that happening now in Gaza. And it's just crazy to be watching a modern Holocaust movie that is unfortunately completely relevant today. Just, you do not want a Holocaust movie to feel timely. And I would say this and Killers of the Flower Moon have like this unsettling, watching now really makes it sing in a different way vibe. So, oh man, the score of this, it's one of the best of the year. Haunting.
I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a well from hell. I don't even know. It's like
I know how to describe it. The only way that I could describe it is the Eyes Wide Shut orgy part, but made more haunting. It's just like vocalists, like just like vocal droning.
Does it have that feeling of just like you're about to be swallowed up by the darkness in this movie? Because it's like there's an overture basically with that. It's all black screen and just that deep voice, and you just feel like you're about to be swallowed up by everything.
And the screen goes red at one point. The way he uses just, I'm telling you, the form of this movie, just unbelievable.
It's impeccable. It's just,
it's like a museum piece or something. Like it just feels like it's hard to not be overwhelmed by it.
I don't want to spoil something, but there is like a flash forward to the future that is, I don't know what made Glazer think to have that moment and that particular scene where it's almost as if the character is having a vision of what the future is going to be like and what the memory of him and his work will be. And
I got chills.
It just, it knocked me. I know. Knocked me out. You are dead on. This is one of the very best films of the year, if not the best. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but it's way up there for me.
And I thought living near a school or a concert venue was bad. Turns out it could be way worse.
Oh my gosh.
It's so fucking hard to watch, man. And then there's like those bursts of like night vision sequences where the girl's doing leaving food out for them, and you're just like crying at the humanity of it and the inhumanity of it. And again, the form, and you're like, why does it look like this? This is so scary.
It's scary because it's not real. And this it is counter to everything that we see and hear in the movie, is someone actually being kind and thinking of the humanity of other people and leaving them food. And so the only way he can present that is as a photo negative of everything we've been watching. It's impeccable, brilliant.
So I think we're both going to agree. It's a 4 out of 4, right?
Oh yeah, easily.
Okay, great. Great. Yeah. It's stunning. It's definitely not for everyone, and it's a hard watch, but I haven't stopped thinking about it, and unfortunately, I do want to go back and watch it again, and thankfully we can. It's in that box set, is it not? It's a Neon, isn't it?
No, it's A24.
Oh, A24. Oh, I guess I don't
know. The other boutique.
The other very nice, indie. Yeah. Exactly. Fantastic movie. If you can stomach it, go check it out. I understand not being able to, though. All right, this next one, talking about stomachs, let's get right into The Taste of Things, which I can only describe as like hardcore X-rated NC-17 food porn. It is just sumptuous. Here's the trailer.
Nous passons plus de temps ensemble que bien des époux.
Je vous le demande encore, Eugénie. Marion.
Combien de fois encore allez-vous me poser cette question?
This movie really snuck up on me in terms of emotional impact. You know, it's a movie about making food and the delicacy and the love and how much goes into that. And I really like, I wish it stuck with the original title, which was the pot-a-feu, which is like one of the dishes they're making in this movie that is like all about It's like the most simple dish possible. So like, why would you ever serve a fancy person this simple dish? It doesn't matter that it's simple. If you make it the right way, it'll be the best thing anyone's ever eaten. And it's just this amazing movie about that power of food, but they tie it in with this like love story in a way that hits really hard for me. Cause it's like, it's about a couple that's not really a couple, but they spend a lot of time together in the kitchen. So it feels like maybe their love is more powerful than regular love. It's really interesting. It's very, it's just like, if you don't like looking at food or watching people make food, stay far away. It's like watching the Food Network. It's like 2 hours of food porn, 2+ hours. But it's kind of magnificent by the end, I would say.
It does take a turn I was not expecting by the end, even though it's set up pretty clearly early on. But, oh man, that opening, which just goes on for like more than 30 minutes of just the two of them and the servant and the niece of the servant
in the kitchen.
Just like, they don't even need to talk. They know exactly what they're doing. They have done this together so many times. They don't need to talk to each other. They could just kind of like figure out like, oh, it's time to get the veal roast or loin or ribs or whatever out of the oven and onto here and baste it and do all this stuff. And just watching them with the timing and the lack of communication, but communicating so much just out of muscle memory and everything. Yes. It's so fascinating to watch. And you learn so much about the characters just from that and the relationship they have. And that's the key to it, is that it's all this unspoken stuff, because they don't talk about how they really feel about each other, except sort of jokingly. Like, he's like, oh, you're going to marry me one day. And she's like, well, I don't really want to get married because I'm, you know, busy cooking for you and all that.
Yeah.
But they mean it. You could tell. You could see they mean it by those little things of just like, they know what their next step is going to be without having to say anything. It's really lovely on that level, just as the study of this relationship where the people don't need to talk to know and understand each other like that. That part of it's really, really great too.
That intimacy, that courtship. I love that open, that scene where I think they're trying to tell her to like have dinner with them. And she's like, no, I don't need to sit here at this table and talk with you. I converse through the food that I make and you eat it. I just love that so much. And about how I think other people call her an artist. I think she's reluctant to be called one. But it very much is an art, and it's a movie about that and the simple pleasures and how meaningful it can be and always innovating and learning, like the electric current in the fucking garden or whatever. Like, I love that too, just how there's always stuff to learn and new things to explore, and how even hot pot, something lowbrow, comfort food with tender loving care can become the most beautiful work of art. So I was quite taken with this movie, ultimately, even though it does take its time to unfold, and you do have to be okay with watching like food boil for a while.
Yeah, I was surprised. There's that quote in the trailer. It said, I swear you could taste every bite. And I'm like, I wish.
Yeah, I fucking I wish. Yeah. All my friends who saw it at the film festival, their reviews are all, the guy next to me would not stop moaning the entire time. And I'm
like, the characters of the movie can't stop either.
I completely understand, though. You're watching it, you're like, oh yeah, oh man, that looks awesome.
they must have showed that like right before lunch at some festival.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean,
great programming if you did that, though, because I
missed opportunity for some smell-o-vision, though. They really could have done some good stuff with this. I found this to be ultimately very moving. It definitely is. It takes its time, but I think it's really rewarding. And if you're like a food movie person, I think it's a very good one of those.
Yeah, like something like Big Night, which is
Big great. Night is so good.
Anyway, okay, so I'm curious, because I know you obviously really like this, I'm curious what your rating is.
I'm toying right now in my head between 3 and 3.5, and I think it's a very strong 3, maybe a light 3.5. What am I feeling right now? I think a very strong 3.
Okay, I'm at that too. I'm just very surprised.
It's just kind of long. Yeah, it's a little long. I don't know.
It's hard to. Yeah, it's one of those things. Like we're just going ecstatic about everything that it does really well, and it does those things really well. But it is.
Yeah, there's some like cliched stuff in there in terms of like character things that happen that I wasn't expecting. It's like, yeah, there's things we could harp on, but I'd rather just say it's really great and. I don't have to talk about what was bad about it. I just liked it. It was nice.
We don't. I did. I mean,
it's one of those things. I saw it like a month ago, so all I remember is the good stuff, you know?
Yeah, the food and the relationship. Yeah. And not so much. I don't, it's weird because the third act, I don't want to say specifically everything that happens, but that third act is interesting because it did hit me on an emotional level, but it also left me feeling a little empty and not in the way I think it's meant to. Mm. Just like, it is missing something because there's no, I hate to say it, there's no resolution to a certain story element. And that's, but that's kind of the point too. It feels wrong to knock it for that, but there's just something off about that third act that I think is holding me back from going higher on it. I'm just trying to figure it out in my own head. Like, why am I not?
I feel the same way. It's always just like an internal calculation. I have no control over it.
It's all about the gut.
I say it, and there it is. I'm really looking forward to making dinner tonight after talking about that again. It's going to be revelatory. I'm going to not talk to my wife the whole time. Be like, I'm speaking through the food.
just see how it goes. Does she know which seasoning to bring?
Yes, you'll figure it out. All right, this next movie, I don't think it has a real release strategy. It's in one theater in New York as of last week. I think it's like kind of touring the country, maybe. It's an interesting movie, even though I don't think it ultimately works. It's called The Sweet East. Here's the trailer.
Hey, oh my God, oh my God. We're not a threat. Don't look at us like that. Sorry.
Excuse
me? You sure you're in the right place? I feel certain I've never seen you at one of these affairs before.
Little Bo Peep has lost her way.
I don't think she'd be scared. I think she's really braver than you think.
The election was a pre-scripted puppet show, just like every year.
No, you two are a complete pair of cosmopolitan snobs, you know that, yeah?
I need to know what's going on down in that basement now.
I appreciate this movie as an elaborate troll in which every like conspiracy theory talking point in the world of this movie, it turns out is true. Like if a character talks about Pizzagate, there's a guy with a gun in the basement of a pizza shop, and lo and behold, there are tunnels in there with strewn about with children's toys. And one of the characters goes, oh, this isn't how I remembered it. So the movie's just, it's taken the piss out of, I don't even know, like society, period. Just like the idea of living in the modern age where people are full of shit and spouting like empty provocations that they don't really mean anything. I appreciated it more than I liked it. And I think it looks so good. It's the directorial debut of Sean Price Williams, who kind of like defines a certain indie style with his cinematography that started with, I think, the movie Frownland in 2007. And he's worked with the Safdies a bunch. He's worked without the Safdies a bunch. He's a great cinematographer known for handheld, textured, grainy, fluid camera work. And all of that stuff looks great. It's just when you get to the movie, that's basically an Alice in Wonderland style road trip movie with a teen girl that's satirizing, again, just like, I guess, the extremism in the U.S. and how people who get involved in it are, I think what it's saying is they're all full of shit and just projecting, spewing nonsense. I think that's what the movie's perspective is. And it's fun to watch for a while. I think the performances are good, but I think as you get in your review, the issue is this character's such a cipher that she's not really a person, and that doesn't make for an interesting protagonist, I guess. Is that where you're hung up, really?
Yeah, I think that's intentional too, that this character is just a shapeshifter, basically. She just has grown up on the internet and doesn't really know who she is. And
in and of itself is a statement about people today and how they're wishy-washy, jumping from one protest song to the next in a completely different register because they're just, I guess the movie says, easily manipulated or, I don't know, bored. It seems like she's just bored.
She's just bored out of her mind. She goes to a trip in DC and she ends up like in a semi anti-fascist group only to somehow slip into a neo-Nazi's apartment. Like those extremes like that you brought up, that's all that it's about. It's just showcasing those and the way that she can just kind of by copying things that she learned from each step along the way, convince the people that she is a true believer in whatever, whether that be Antifa or neo-Nazism or just independent filmmaking, apparently. That's a weird, yes. It's such a weird, that part is so strange. The whole thing about her getting involved in this period movie.
Yeah.
And I, because everything else is very overtly political. The last one is another one. I don't want to say what it is because
yeah.
It is. It does kind of like come as a bit of a surprise and also fitting into a certain stereotype I'm not sure about. But everything is a stereotype in this movie. I mean, there's that weird little fantasy sequence in, I guess, in Hollywood. I don't know if she actually makes it out to LA or not, but there's like this weird creature that is clearly ripped off from South Park.
Yeah.
Of a certain stereotype. And I'm like, what is this doing here?
I know.
There's a lot of that sort of fantasy stuff. And I don't know if it's just trying to prod us with, hey, you recognize this, right? You recognize the Pizzagate conspiracy, right? And you recognize this grossly offensive stereotype of a Hollywood person, right? You get it, right? And I like, okay, but what's
it definitely has that provocateur, edgy to be annoying thing going on, which is why I don't ultimately jive with it. But yeah. I am very compelled by that narrative arc of the character arc. I do think it's very incisive and accurate to be like, this is how a lot of modern people operate and think and just kind of repeat what they hear on Twitter and then, you know, fall in with a group like that. Like, I relate to that. I find that very interesting. But the movie around it, it's just too freewheeling for its own good, I think. And that's okay. I think there are some people who will love this. It's just very experimental, indie, not really a narrative piece, just kind of Alice in Wonderland. Again, the only way I could describe it is my friend called it Dirtbag Alice in Wonderland. And I'm like, that's pretty good. Yeah. So like, it's fun. And even my friend who liked it was like, there's so many jokes that I thought were terrible, but like, I can't just dismiss it outright because I do think it's a singular kind of experience that there is value in. So I'm ultimately like 2.5 stars on this very weird indie movie that I appreciate some of the things that it's saying. I don't know if I know all of what it's saying, but yeah, I don't know. Do you agree that it looks nice at least?
It looks nice. I think it does work better as a collection of ideas than a narrative. That's where I'm at with it. I think I get what it's trying to do with having that vapid character who can adapt and everything. I think I get it. And that maybe by the end, it's better that you are like that than to become a true believer in something because of where it ends up. I think I get it, but I'm still not compelled enough by the narrative itself, which just sort of rambles and ambles about.
Yes,
and
it does.
I appreciate more the ideas it's trying to present than the movie itself. So,
I'm really open to the idea. I'm open to the idea of rewatching this and being like, wow, I totally get it. I think it's brilliant. But I haven't done that yet. So right now it's 2.5. All right. And the last movie of the week, or the second to last
or is
movie
it? Of the week. We'll find out.
We don't know. Ooh. Concrete Utopia. Here's the trailer. Now this, I hesitate to not, I'm going to go ahead and say it, a pretty derivative premise that we've seen before, but done in a unique enough way and compelling enough characters and stuff that I ultimately still liked it. But explain what this movie is. And I feel like people will be like, yeah, okay, I've seen something like that before.
Yeah, you've seen probably both of these things before in some way. First off, it's a disaster movie. Seoul, yes, or all of Korea or the entire planet, who knows, we don't know, is upended, literally turned over on its side in a giant earthquake that leaves the entire city in rubble except for a single apartment building. And that single apartment building is full of residents who are trying to find food and find water and find all the equipment they need just to survive. So it turns into a sort of a Lord of the Flies thing because they start their own society. And the society has a ruler and it has a board and it has a police force and a hospital and a food depository and all that stuff. It has all the essentials. And then it very easily slides into fascism. And that was what got me. I think it starts off as a very specific notion of the housing crisis that is either about to happen or is currently happening in Korea right now. Okay. Because, I mean, the whole world, I think, is either in that, in the
middle
of
it. One giant housing crisis. Or just, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's all from your perspective. Are you looking for a house or do you own a bunch of property? Are we in a housing crisis or not? That's kind of where this is at, I think, there too. But it turns into this whole thing about how easily this authoritarian government with a lot of good intentions of just keeping people alive can slide into that, into outright fascism of trying to say anyone who's outside of this apartment building is a cockroach. They don't deserve to live. We should steal everything we can from them because they're taking everything from us. It's like, it's frightening on that level because we've seen that in the past. We've never seen a disaster like this, thankfully, and hopefully never will because it's so over the top. Hopefully nothing like that happens.
I think the whole premise is, what if an entire earthquake took out everything but one building? Which,
yeah,
it's not a great premise, but it's not reality.
Yeah. But I think the human drama and the political drama that's going on is eerily accurate. And that's what hit for me.
Totally. And I think the movie does a good job of setting up internal conflict and drama, like with the guy who becomes the leader, like, you know, something's up with him. And I was ultimately with it. Like, I didn't mean to start by saying it's derivative, blah, 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 just because, like, I think ultimately you're watching it. You're like, okay, it's like a class allegory. It's like Snowpiercer, but it's a tower. And everyone inside is, you know, good versus the outsiders who are bad. And I love the idea of, in this post-apocalyptic world, you know, there's no high or low anymore. Everything is reset. The banks are gone. You have no loans anymore. The rich are now the poor and begging outside. And the people that happen to have this apartment are now the you know, the powerful ones. And you're right. Nice people turn into violent savages very fast. So, like, it sounds on paper like kind of boring and derivative, like I've seen it. But it unfolds. It's a well-made thriller, right? Like, I was.
Yeah, it has interesting characters. We understand these characters. The main couple, they're this dichotomy between someone who's almost cowardly, or at least pragmatic about how to survive, and then his wife is, you know, a nurse who wants to try to take care of people and get the best for them. And then the leader is this guy who seems very charismatic, but he's got a secret that turns him into a hypocrite. It's all that stuff that's going on. Yeah. It's good on that level. Not just, like I said, not just the political drama, but the human drama that's happening.
Yeah. Like, how fast we become entitled. And, like, before the earthquake, this guy could barely make rent. And now he's lamenting that this kid is mooching off of him and, like, living in his house. So, like, yeah, it's really interesting stuff. I like that they focus on the large crisis, but also home in on, as you said, that single couple and their marriage and their difference in response and how she can't believe his inhumanity. Like, it is how that would go. And it was compelling to watch. It's about distribution of resources and policing and typical post-apocalypse stuff. It reminded me a lot of Land of the Dead, which is like a zombie movie post-apocalypse that's very centered on, like, class and a building versus everybody else.
Yeah, that is the one that takes place, like, in a walled off city, right?
Yeah. Yeah. With Dennis Hopper owning the building.
Yes.
It's great. It's very good. So I love any movie that reminds me of Land of the Dead. It was good. It delivers as the human drama. It delivers as, I mean, I guess it has some, like, earthquake spectacle in flashbacks. All that stuff's like whatever. It's pretty CGI, whatever. But the movie is good. It is a good, what do you call it? Thought provoking thriller. Or, like, if you like, you've seen it before for sure, as you mentioned, with the several other movies, but it's a good variation on that theme. And I found it perfectly fine, perfectly enjoyable. It's a 3-star movie.
Yeah. 3 stars for me too.
Very much.
It's,
so
it's various places, like all these other smaller movies we talked about. I think this one's expanded a bit. So it's not just New York, LA. I think it has expanded over the last week or so. So
yeah. Keep an eye out. Check out your local theater. See if Concrete Utopia is there. Otherwise, check on VOD shortly. It should be there eventually. We have flash forwarded in time. We are here in the future. Mark and Brett from the future are here inserting ourselves into the past so we can talk about the seventh movie. We did have time to watch it. Thank you so much, Apple, for giving us access to the family plan. The podcast would not have been complete without this. Here is the trailer for The Family Plan on Apple TV Plus, I guess is what that service is called. Here is the trailer.
Oh, hey, Dan.
Happy anniversary.
Dan, my husband, he's an amazing dad.
You almost ready to go to size 4S, huh? Are you so big?
Look at the big muscles.
I just wish our lives were bigger.
Really? At least let me put my kid down. Sorry about the mess. Hold on. Oh, hey, Bo.
Hey, Dan.
Don't hang up.
I need no identities. I'm burnt.
Me, my wife, and 3 kids.
Have you told them yet?
I'll tell them when I'm on the road.
Meet me in Vegas in 3 days.
This is crazy.
Look at that. We're going to Vegas. Woo.
Oh, yes. So pumped.
Nothing.
That trailer kind of shows the whole trajectory of the movie. And then, of course, there's a turn where what happens, what's inevitably going to happen, has to happen with the family and their knowledge of what's going on. I don't even know where to begin. I'll just let Mark start talking about this because otherwise this isn't going to go well.
It's not good. It's not good.
It's a bad film, Mark.
It is a bad movie. It is a bad movie. I'm going to give it a little bit of credit, if only because the premise, while entirely familiar, about the guy who has the dark secret from his past and it all comes back to haunt him and he has to fight against it and keep his family out of danger.
It's family style, A History of Violence.
Yeah. Or Nobody. Or
The Pacifier.
That's not the point. The point is the concept of him trying to hide all of that from his family while all of these guys are coming at him to attack him. I kind of like that idea. That is a good, it's a decent setup for a screwball comedy.
Yes.
Where you have, this guy has to hide all of this violence he's doing in the background from his family. It's a decent idea. The problem is, I don't think this movie cares that it's a comedy. It doesn't care about the jokes. It doesn't care. It only cares about the action, and the action is poorly done. That trailer is really good to just show the editing. That fight scene in the grocery, that is how it is cut. That is not trailer editing.
And
that is how it's cut. Every blow, there's a cut to the next one. It's cut. It's so frustrating.
Yes, and also I will say one way to get around criticism of having bad sitcom lighting is to literally have your fight scene in the supermarket where those lights are already there and garish, so they don't even try to light the fucking scene interestingly. So it has, yes, bad editing. It has bad lighting. It looks like TV, like my classic streaming era criticism. It does not look like a movie. There's nothing cinematic about it. And what I'm struck by is exactly what you said. There's no jokes in this movie. Like, this is the awful bare bones outline of a derivative premise without any jokes in it, where usually at some stage this would get punched up and jokes would be added, or the star of the movie, they would give it to someone with improv experience who could liven it up and make it funnier. But they gave it to Mark Wahlberg, who is not a comedian, in my opinion, and has nothing to do here, does not add any charm or hilarity to it. It is just barely a script hung together with tropes and cliches. And even what you said, like, I got so tired of that so fast when, like, the first hour of the movie, the first hour of this 2-hour movie is him pretending that he doesn't have the dark past and isn't an assassin and isn't this guy who can fight, who's hiding in a normal family. It's him just doing that and pretending like everything's fine. And what I didn't like about what makes the script so bad, Mark, is like there's just no believability to even like his family going along with the trip to Vegas stuff. Like it's also broad and stupid. It's hard to believe that like the mom would be like, okay, I guess we're going to Vegas spontaneously. This isn't weird at all. You just have to kind of get on board with all of the silliness, which I would be fine with if the movie had any laughs. Mark, I didn't laugh one time. I had my like laugh counter stopwatch out and it didn't go off once. It just doesn't have any jokes. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I think it had, I think it tries a couple of jokes. It doesn't, they don't work. Yes. That's the problem. They don't work. Part of it is Wahlberg, who I think he's not a comedic actor. He's not a comedian, but he can be funny. He can be funny. If
yes.
He, yeah. Dry and deadpan.
The other guy is a great example.
Yes. Yeah. Dry and deadpan. He's hilarious in The Departed. He's just playing, but he, you know, that's his kind of comedy. If he's going to do comedy, this needs somebody who can be broader, who's not just there to look bored by the material. I don't think he knows
everybody
what he's doing. I don't
think bored.
Anybody. Yeah. Nobody knows what's going on here. It's a mess of different ideas and different tones. None of it works on that level. What are some good things? Michelle Monaghan is delightful.
I love Michelle Monaghan.
I do too. Always. Every time she shows up, you know, at least that part of the movie is going to be like, okay, I get it. She's good here. In a role that is entirely thankless, it doesn't make a lick of sense. But she's good. I feel bad for Kieran Hines showing up as the bad guy
I could not believe that he was in this.
I could not either. Maggie Q is in this, and why is she doing in here? There's so many actors. Those are the two. Those are the two main ones. They show up like at the beginning and then at the end, and you're like, what are you? Why did you sign on for this? I don't understand it. Whatever. I don't know. I didn't abhor it. I really, really didn't like it though. I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to have those.
Yeah. Hey man.
I do like the idea.
I gave a pass to a very similarly titled movie that Netflix put out a couple weeks ago called Family Switch. And I just think it's so perfect that the streamers are making such algorithmic content down to the titles being like, so family plan, family switch. And it makes me, I'm so cynical about like the world of spec scripts and screenwriters who are all trying to get on the blacklist. This was a blacklist script, Mark. Can you that is the most.
Yes, I can. I have seen some of the other movies that are on that.
That's what I'm saying. It is the biggest indictment of the blacklist that this garbage is on it. And it's because it's sellable. Like, I understand. Like, it's just like mainstream, give it to the masses, put a star in it. There's no effort needs to be made. It just sucks that this is what sells. But the funniest, want to know what's funnier, Mark, than anything in this entire movie? This writer, Mark, I follow him on Twitter because he wrote a movie that I love. He wrote Orphan First Kill, the sequel, many years later sequel to Orphan that none of us expected to exist or be good. And it existed and it was great.
Yeah, we reviewed that if you want to go back in the archive.
Yeah, go to the archive.
Both of us liked it.
Yeah, surprising hit, big horror hit of last year for me, even though it got a horrible non-release and did not go to theaters. It went to some theaters. Weird strategy.
It was weird, yeah.
Sidebar, anyway. The guy wrote that, and then if you dig around, you can see he's been writing spec scripts. You can find the spec script he wrote from 2011, which is just basically like, you know, a vague outline of a script with like a broad idea. Like this one was probably like family has to go on the run with hitman dad. And it's Mark Wahlberg. Like that's probably the whole spec script. And they're like, we'll give you $5 million. Thank you so much. Anyway, he said when this movie got added to the blacklist, his brag or his reverse brag, whatever you want to call this, his quote tweet of the news that this script got added to the blacklist was, I sent this script to my agents and they fired me. And now it's on the blacklist. So just unbelievable. I can't believe he admitted that publicly. I would never admit if I wrote the screenplay, Mark, I would sell it and get my money and I would not let my name be on it. But this guy is on Twitter going off about how this is like a passion project for him and how he's so excited to sold it. I just think he's a guy who's been writing spec scripts forever and finally has success. But it reminded me, are you familiar with Tom Lennon and Robert Ben Grant? Tom Lennon, the comedian.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Screenwriter. Yep. Yeah. So they wrote a book called Writing Screenplays for Fun and Profit, I believe it's called. And it's about how they know Tom Lennon's whole thing is, yeah, I write garbage screenplays because that's what sells. Like he acknowledges in the book that he writes that like there's a formula to follow if you want to sell like a family film. And his credits include The Pacifier, which this movie is very much trying to be. And Night at the Museum, I think he wrote Balls of Fury, Baywatch. He writes a lot of stuff, but like, it just reeks of that kind of thing to me, of like a guy who just wants to sell something, so he wrote it, which is fine. I just find it hilarious that this guy is like tweeting about this movie as if it's amazing. I'm trying to find another tweet where he said, "I kept getting notes on this screenplay to get rid of the baby, but I couldn't get rid of the baby because the baby," what does he say? "It just made me laugh so much. I will concede, cut the baby is almost always a good note in terms of preventing production headaches, but I couldn't do it. Max is too crucial to the story." This is hilarious. Why didn't this hilarious guy channel any of this humor into the script? Where is any of this?
I don't know. But you do have all those baby reaction shots, and I guess those are the jokes. I don't.
Well, that was done by, wasn't it Fast 8 or 7 or something? There's a whole thing with Jason Statham and the baby where the whole thing is like, look, this baby's in peril in a gunfight. They just do that in this movie. It's just like repeated nonsense. Yeah. I just think it's so funny that this was a spec that was so toxic, his agents dropped him, and then the blacklist is so full of garbage screenplays that they picked this shit up, and now we have a very expensive, probably for no reason, Apple movie that everyone will maybe watch for like an hour and then give it up with it because it's terrible. I just find it fascinating, and I'm glad we reconvened to talk about it, even though it is absolutely, I feel like I'm being very kind in saying it's a one-star movie. I feel like it very easily could be half.
I can see that, and I feel very even kinder saying it's 1.5 stars, and that's just because, just vague feelings once again. It's just, I didn't hate it. I didn't abhor it. I easily could have, but it's whatever.
I think
it's 1.5 stars. I'm not, this is not praise. It's a bad, bad movie.
It's really bad, and it's just that low effort, like, I just can't believe, it doesn't feel like it was written by, like, a guy recently. It feels like it was either generated by an algorithm that spit out generic family comedy with these parameters, or it feels like something that's been sitting in a drawer that's already been done a million times. It just, I'm shocked that someone is proud of this, and I'm sorry if he's listening and he's like really hurt by this, but I don't really care. This movie fucking sucked. It was 2 hours of my time. I'll never get back. Hated it. If it was 2024, it would be the worst movie I've seen this year. It's 2023. I don't know if that's that.
I think we've seen worse.
I don't know, actually. It's up there. It's definitely top, bottom three, I guess.
Yeah. Orphan First Kill, though. Good movie.
Orphan First Kill's great. So, David, if you're listening, don't be mad at me. I really hope you get another Orphan movie. He wrote a Lee Daniels directed horror movie that's coming out called The Deliverance. So I hope that's good. Always hoping. I'm rooting for this guy, but The Family Plan ain't it. I almost want to say, like, you know, good job, man. You sold your spec script. And I wish I just wish he had the dignity to say that it's garbage and not be so proud that he's saying he couldn't cut Max because Max is too crucial to the story. What do you think that means? Would you agree?
I don't know what it means. I don't want to interpret it. I don't feel like it.
I'm sorry.
Supposed to go less than 10 minutes.
I love roping you into my incendiary bullshit. It's so funny. We have nothing against this guy.
It's nothing personal. It's nothing never personal. Anything personal.
It's just so funny that before that cut the baby thing I read, it was a quote tweet of him quote tweeting a Apple tweet that had like a featurette about the movie. And he said, "Cut the baby was a recurring note. Now the baby's got its own featurette." It's this stuff's killing me. If I were rating this guy's Twitter feed, it would be a 4 out of 4. But the movie is a 1. I am so sorry. Don't cancel the podcast. Don't review bomb me, David Kogeshal. I will splice back in the ending of the podcast here. Okay. Bye. I'm so sorry that I did that to you. God. But I hope you found it funny too. Okay.
I did, yes.
I know I'm being an asshole, but he's being ridiculous. He's being ridiculous.
No, it is funny.
Okay.
You can cut around it if you listen to it again. And you're like, that felt a little excessive. You can cut around it, but it was funny. That's it.
Okay.
I have no notes except that if you feel like you went too far. No.
I'm looking at his feed and I can go much farther. I was too busy laughing. Michelle Monaghan tweeted at him, thank you for writing one of my most favorite roles ever.
Oh, no.
Not going to lie, this feels pretty good. Like, you know, why am I shitting on this guy?
Hey, that's honest.
I know. Yeah. This guy's having a great time. And I'm just like, you shouldn't be. This is garbage. You should not be proud of this. All right. We'll be back next week with your Christmas releases and all the odds and ends of the year that they just throw out, even though Mark and I probably saw them like a month ago. And I wish we talked about them then. But I'm excited for you to see Iron Claw. Really good one. A lot of good stuff coming out next week. We'll see you then. Alien Ant Farm, take it away.
The show starts in one.
Shut up. Ush.